Thank you very much, Secretary General. You ended there saying that the world's changed and therefore NATO has changed. But to what extent do you think Russia, who were, you know, originally the power you were blocking in terms of the Warsaw Pact, in terms of potential Soviet invasion, to what extent are they once again the greatest threat to European stability and European peace?
So we don't see any imminent threat from Russia against any NATO country. But what we see is a more assertive Russia, a Russia which has over many years invested heavily in defense. They have tripled their defense spending since year 2000 in real terms. They have modernized capabilities. They are exercising more. They are much more modern and capable defense capabilities now than they had just a few years ago. And they're also modernizing their nuclear forces, and they're also using a lot of, what should I say, rhetoric to intimidate neighbors, also related to their nuclear forces, rhetoric related to the use of nuclear forces. But the most important thing is that we have seen a Russia which is willing to use military force against neighbors. We saw it first in 2008 in Georgia, but even more serious, we saw it in Ukraine, where they illegally annexed Crimea, and where they continue to destabilize eastern Ukraine. And the illegal annexation of Crimea is the first time since the end of the Second World War in Europe that one country has used force to annex a part of another country. So all of this is the reason why we have stepped up, why we are investing more in collective defense, not because we want confrontation, not because we want a new arms race, but because we have to respond in a measured, responsible, proportionate way to make sure that there is no miscalculations in Moscow about our resolve to protect and defend all allies.
So what do you think are the reasons for this sort of aggressive rhetoric, the increased defense spending? Are Russia simply paranoid, or is there an expansionist agenda?
I think it's always, what should I say, I'm a bit reluctant to speculate too much about the thinking, but what we can see is what they actually do. And what they actually do is they are trying to re-establish some kind of sphere of influence in the neighborhood, to re-establish the thinking we had after the Second World War with the Yalta Agreement, where Europe was divided in spheres of interest. That is history. That is not a way to, what should I say, govern Europe, because that is undermining or violating the respect for each and every nation's sovereignty and a right to decide its own path. So we don't believe in spheres of influence. We believe in the independence and the sovereignty of all nations. But what Russia does in Georgia, in Moldova, in Ukraine, and in other countries is to try to, in different ways, to re-establish some kind of neighborhood which they control. And especially for the Baltic countries, which were part of the Soviet Union, of course for them it is extremely important to have the guarantees from NATO that we will protect them, that they will be independent, free countries, and that NATO is there to make sure that no one violates the sovereignty and the territorial integrity of those countries.
So another place that Russia seems to have some influence is in the mind of President-elect Donald Trump, who has hinted that he might be willing to join Putin in Syria to re-establish the total rule of Bashar al-Assad and defeating ISIS in the process. If this is not simply rhetoric, and if it is true, what does it mean for NATO, and what does it mean for Russia's sort of former satellite states?
First of all, the important thing is that I am absolutely certain that the United States will continue to be committed to NATO and to our collective defense and to U.S. security guarantees to Europe. And I spoke with President-elect last week on the phone, and he expressed strong support to NATO. He expressed strong support to the idea of NATO, of our collective defense, our security guarantees. And I am certain that that will continue to be the case, also not only because President-elect Donald Trump stated clearly that he supports the NATO and the obligations we all have made in being members of the alliance. But I also strongly believe it because strong NATO is not only good for Europe, it's obviously good for us because that is, cornerstone of our security. But it's also good for the United States. I think that two world wars and the Cold War have taught us all, including the United States, that stability, peace in Europe is also important for the United States. And we have to remember that the first time we invoked the Article 5, the Collective Defense Clause of NATO, was after an attack on the United States, after the 9/11 attacks on the United States back in 2001, showing that NATO solidarity is also important for them. And hundreds of thousands of European NATO soldiers have served in Afghanistan in an operation which was triggered directly as a result of an attack on the United States. So I am certain that the United States will continue to be committed to NATO. Then, for NATO, it is no problem that NATO allies talk to Russia on different issues. Actually, NATO decided at our summit in Warsaw in July this year that we will keep channels for political dialogue open with Russia. Russia is our biggest neighbor, and we have to talk to them. We cannot isolate them. We have to sit down and address different issues, both as NATO, as an alliance, but also individual allies. And for instance, the United States, they have spoken with Russia on issues related to Syria many times, both on how to try to find a peaceful negotiated solution, but also how to make sure that there is no, accidents taking place in Syria where both Russian forces operate and the United States operates. Russia was instrumental when it came to regarding the Iran nuclear deal. So to speak to Russia, to talk to Russia, to have dialogue with Russia is absolutely in line with NATO policies and NATO decisions. So that's nothing we should be concerned of.
Okay, and one of Donald Trump's major gripes with NATO is similar to your own. It's people not paying their way, not reaching this 2%. And in fact, there's four countries in Europe that make that 2%. And it's, as you said, it's England, Poland, Estonia, and Greece. What's the reason that the other countries aren't paying their way?
The reason is that almost all politicians I have met, they would prefer to spend money on defense, on education, on health, and infrastructure instead of defense. Because most people like education, health, more than defense. So if politicians have opportunity to spend more on the more on health and education and less on defense, they will do it. And I think we also have to understand that this is linked to the fact that for many years we saw tensions going down. After the end of the Cold War, tensions went down. The Warsaw Pact was dissolved, and we felt that we lived in a safer world. And I have told many people before that when I was Minister of Finance back in Norway in the 1990s, I was responsible for cutting defense spending. And I was quite, impressed by my ability to do so. But when I became Prime Minister later on, I was also responsible for increasing defense spending in Norway after 2008. And the reason why I'm saying that is that I think it's absolutely understandable that countries reduce defense spending when tensions are going down, as long as they're able to increase defense spending when tensions are increasing and we live in a more dangerous world. And that's exactly the case now. So yes, it was possible to explain why we reduced in the 1990s and perhaps in the beginning of the year 2000, but now we have to be able to increase. As I said, the picture in Europe is still very mixed, but at least the picture in Europe is better than it was 2 years ago. Because in 2014 we made a decision to start increased defense spending, and now European allies have started to move in that direction. The UK leads by example, because more nations are now following the UK and have started to increase defense spending.
But do you think there is something to worry about in Europe, in that stable Europe you describe, with the recent Brexit referendum here and potential referendum in France if Marine Le Pen gets in, that the EU could disintegrate? And we'd see sort of more sectarian violence as we're used to in maybe 100 years ago.
First, I would like to state that what we have seen is, of course, for many, many years that there has been a lot of debate about the European Union. We have seen different discussions about the future of the European Union, and that is important. But at the same time, we have seen that NATO has remained united and strong. So of course, Brexit, that's not for me to comment. I don't have any opinion on Brexit. But Brexit has not, made NATO less united. If anything, the opposite. NATO is an alliance of 28 democracies, soon to be 29 with Montenegro. People in different allied countries elect people from or leaders from different parties with different political views. There are many different opinions among leaders in NATO countries, but we have always proven that we are able to agree on our core task, to be together, to stand together, and to protect each other. And as long as we are able to do that, NATO is able to deliver what we are supposed to deliver, strong collective defense, deterrence, and by that protecting all allies. So I will not go into the debate about the future of the European Union, but I have seen that NATO has been able to stay united, stay strong, also in times where we see more instability and political uncertainties around us.
So one of those nations with a complex relationship with the European Union but a strong relationship with NATO is Turkey. Now in 2015, Turkey invoked Article 4 after threats by ISIS to its territorial integrity. Yet Kurdish forces accuse Turkey of enabling and even helping ISIS. Can Turkey rely on NATO support to protect itself from ISIS but also use ISIS to pursue an anti-Kurdish agenda?
Turkey is a key ally for NATO. Not least because of its geographical location. Turkey is bordering Syria and Iraq, bordering ISIL in Syria and Iraq, and Turkey is bordering both Ukraine and Russia in the north in the Black Sea, and Georgia in the east. So Turkey has the second largest army in NATO. Turkey hosts 3 million, around 3 million refugees. So Turkey is key, both when it comes to the way we respond to a more assertive Russia, but also in the way NATO addresses the challenges with turmoil, violence to the south, ISIL, Daesh, but also to the migrant and refugee crisis. All of this makes Turkey important, not only for NATO, but for the whole of Europe and also for the European Union. Turkey is a member of NATO, but not member of the European Union. I visited Istanbul, where I met with President Erdogan on Monday. We discussed many different challenges we face together. But one of the challenges, of course, we discussed was the fight against ISIL. And Turkey has now stepped up its efforts to fight ISIL. They have ground troops in Syria and in Iraq where they fight ISIL. And the important thing for me is that there is maximum coordination between Turkey with its forces in Syria and US and other NATO allies which are present in the same countries. NATO as an alliance is not present in Syria. NATO as an alliance supports Turkey. We have increased our military presence. We call them assurance measures in Turkey. and we are supporting the alliance, but NATO as an organization is not which is responsible for the ongoing operations in Syria. So how those operations are conducted, I think it's right of me to leave to the US, Turkey, and the other countries which are on the ground.
Thank you very much. I'd now like to go to the audience. If you have a question, put your hand up high and wait for the microphone to get to you. Could we go to the gentleman on that side? Yeah.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for being here today. You spoke a lot about NATO's deterrence capability vis-a-vis Russia. And I wonder, it seems to me that the deterrence capability is best, it's best organized to deter a conventional threat. And there's a lot of talk today about hybrid warfare as the threat that emanates from Russia. And I wonder if Russia isn't really operating with tanks and fighter aircraft and overland assault, but rather through propaganda, political subversion, little green men. How exactly is NATO positioned to deter that threat?
First of all, I think you're very right that cyber and different kinds of covert operations, sometimes called hybrid warfare, is a very big challenge. And many of the threats we have seen have been much more related to that kind of warfare than more conventional attacks. And what we saw in Crimea was what is referred to as hybrid warfare with what you called little green men, where it's hard to, in a way, where the idea is to conduct covert operations to deny, in a way, responsibility and then create and use propaganda and so on to try to destabilize the country and by that also conduct aggressive operations. This was one of the issues I discussed with Prime Minister Theresa May yesterday. Cyber is extremely important in modern warfare. It's hard to imagine any conflict without a cyber component. And UK is lead. UK has capabilities, competence, skills in cyber, which is of high value for all of us. NATO has decided, and we are in the process of strengthening our cyber defenses at the summit again in Warsaw in July this year. We made two important decisions. First, we made the decision to establish cyber as a domain, as a military domain. So now we have air, sea, land, and cyber as military domains. And that will enable us to better coordinate our efforts, to better focus our efforts related to cyber and cyber attacks. Second, we agreed on a cyber pledge, which is a kind of roadmap on how we, in many different ways, can increase and strengthen our cyber defenses. That's partly about protecting our own networks against cyber attacks, and partly about assisting, helping allies to improve their defenses of their own networks. Because the first responder is the nation, then NATO is there to help and assist if needed. And the important thing with cyber is that's something which is ongoing. Because when you speak about other kinds of threats, there is a kind of theoretical possibility that we'll have a conventional attack sometime in the future. But cyber, that happens almost daily against NATO allies and NATO. So we have to defend ourselves against cyber attacks every day. And one of the key issues about that is attribution, is to tell who's behind. And so increased and improved cyber defenses is high on our agenda. And the Prime Minister May is very focused on that. UK is lead nation, and we work closely with the UK in addressing those challenges.
Thanks. More questions, please. If we go to the man over there.
Wait, microphone. Thank you. So if we look back at NATO-Russian relations starting with the beginning of the post-Soviet period, so there was a period of dialogue and even expectations that a new democratic Russia would actually join NATO. Then by the end of the 90s, with the bombings of Yugoslavia, with many post-communist states becoming NATO members, these relations have really gone sour. Then there was a rapprochement after the 9/11 when Putin supported Bush in the war of terror in Afghanistan. Then starting with, I think, the Iraq war, there's been a constant period of falling and deteriorating relations. So my question is that has NATO membership or some sort of a of joint security programs with Russia, have they ever been on the table? And if the cooperation with post-Soviet Russia failed, why do you think is the reason for such failure?
So first of all, you are quite right in that for several years, we actually established closer and closer cooperation and dialogue with Russia. And I was myself, Prime Minister, attending different NATO summits where Putin attended and Medvedev attended, President Putin and Prime Minister Medvedev, order changed. So that was an example of how we were working together. And we also had practical cooperation in different fields. Of course, there were some ups and downs, but at least we were moving in the direction of more cooperation. The main reason, there are different reasons, but the main reason why this has changed is Crimea. The illegal annexation of Crimea. To use military force against the neighbor is unacceptable. And of course, NATO had to respond. And we have responded partly by increasing our military presence in the eastern part of the Alliance to send a clear signal that that we are ready to defend all allies against anything similar to what has happened in Ukraine, Crimea. We also responded by suspending our practical cooperation with Russia. So we still have political dialogue with Russia, but we don't have practical cooperation with them. And then, of course, the West has also responded by implementing economic sanctions against Russia. That's not a NATO decision, but all NATO allies have, through the European Union or the United States, Canada, they have implemented sanctions. So the main reason for the worsening or the deteriorating relationship is Crimea. Then the question is, why did Russia do that? Well, I think it is because they have this idea of some kind of, they want to control the neighbors. And to control neighbors is not compatible with the idea of sovereign nations and sovereign states. I'm coming from a neighbor state of Russia. And of course, I'm very glad that they haven't tried to control Norway in the same way as they have tried to control other neighbors. But at the same time, one of the lessons I have learned from Norwegian politics is that it is possible to talk to Russians. It is possible to have a dialogue with them. And Norway, having a very long borderline in the sea, where we have gas and oil in the Barents Sea and the polar sea, but also on land, we have been able to work in a pragmatic way, both with the Soviet Union during the Cold War, but also with Russia. But the reason why we have been able to work with Russia is not despite of our membership in NATO, but it's more because of. Because as long as we are strong, as long as we are part of a strong military alliance, we have the best possible foundation also to engage in dialogue with Russia. So I believe that we have to stay strong, we have to stay united, but based on that, we should continue to work and strive for a more cooperative and constructive relationship with Russia. We should continue to have channels for political dialogue open and manage our relationship with Russia as good as we can, because Russia will not disappear. Russia will be there. Russia will be our biggest neighbor. And therefore, we have to relate to them in the best possible way.
Do you think one of the reasons you were appointed as Secretary General is because you have experience in this sort of cooperative dialogue with Russia from when you were Prime Minister?
It's hard for me, in a way, to answer why the leaders of NATO appointed me. But at least what they have, what they have said, some of them is that it has also to do with my experience. Put it another way, of course, it has to do with my experience as Norwegian politician, because that's what I've done all my life until I became Secretary General. So it's hard to imagine something else. And one important part of my political life in Norway has been to relate to Russia. Actually, when I became deputy minister for environment back in 1990, one of my first tasks was to start to work with Russia on addressing pollution, the emissions of sulfur up in the Kola Peninsula, which damaged a lot of nature also in Norway. And I went to Zapoljarny and Murmansk and different cities there at the Kola Peninsula, and we discussed practical environmental cooperation. Then later on in the 1990s, I became Minister for Energy and Industry, and we had a lot of commission, we had a Norwegian, Russian commission on industry and energy. We met in Moscow, we met in Oslo, and we developed a lot of projects on energy and industry with the Russians. And that was mutual benefit both for Norway and for Russia. And then when I was Prime Minister, we worked on the delimitation line, which is then the borderline in the sea, in the Barents Sea. But this is important partly because it's a big sea territory, but also because it divides the continental shelf, and there is oil and gas there. And we were able to reach an agreement with President Putin and Prime Minister Medvedev. That was good for Norway, it was good for Russia. And part of that agreement is also that we are going to cooperate up in the high north related to energy. And also when I was Prime Minister, I also, and that's still the case, we have to know that the Russian military, the 6th Fleet, the north the fleet up at the Kola Peninsula, they meet with the Norwegian armed forces every week. At least they communicate with them regularly to make sure that there are no misunderstandings, no incidents, and no accidents. We also have some joint exercises with them related to search and rescue and so on up in the Barents Sea. So the reason why I say this is that in the north, there is some practical, let's say, pragmatic relations between a NATO ally, Norway, and Russia. But that takes place based on some absolute principles that they respect our sovereignty, our territorial integrity. And actually, they respect it so much that they've agreed on a new borderline. And of course, it's based on the knowledge that NATO that Norway is a NATO ally. So even if Norway is not a very big power, they know that NATO is there to protect and defend us. So for me, Norway is an excellent example of how strength and dialogue, defense and dialogue, is not something which contradict each other, but reinforce each other. And I guess that's one of the reasons why I was elected to Secretary General of NATO.
Thanks. Let's take another question from the audience. Let's go to the sort of turquoise jumper.
Can you understand that Vladimir Putin sees it as a provocation that the NATO has expanded to the east after the end of the Cold War, especially in the light of the belief of apparently some Russians that the negotiations about the reunion of Germany were based on the promise or implicit promise that the NATO would not expand to former Warsaw Pact countries?
The answer is no. I cannot understand that Russia so has the opinion that it is a provocation that NATO has enlarged with new members from Central and Eastern Europe. And the reason why I can't understand that and I cannot accept that is that I very much believe that every nation, big or small, east or west, have the right to decide its own path. So it's not, in a way, it's not NATO that has expanded. It is Poland, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, Hungary that has applied for membership because they want to become members through democratic processes. And should we then tell them, no, you are not allowed to come to become a member of NATO because Russia will not like it? That's an impossible message. And it's violating everything I believe in when it comes to the respect for people to decide their own destiny and their own future. So the whole notion of NATO expanding sounds like we are, in a way, grabbing land. No, they are coming to us, asking for membership, and after a very thorough assessment procedure, and they have to qualify and meet standards and implement reforms, then they are invited in. But only as long as there are democratic processes and they meet the NATO standards and after many years of assessment. So this is based on the idea that Russia has the right to decide the destiny of its neighbors. And Russia do not have that right, but neither do any other country. So for instance, yesterday, I met the Serbian Prime Minister, and Serbia do not want to become member of NATO. That's fine. We respect countries if they say we don't want to be a member of NATO, and we respect them if they say they want to be a member of NATO. It's not for us to decide, it's for them to decide. And Russia should be more relaxed and accept that neighbors decide their own path. And that will be good for the neighbors and for Russia.
Let's go to back middle. Yeah, you're turning around.
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary General. I wanted to ask you about Afghanistan. NATO has been involved in Afghanistan since 2003. I think Operation Resolute Support is going into its third year now, and 10 years prior to that with ISAF. The treasure and blood that has been spilt in Afghanistan is quite astounding in NATO's history. And I wanted to ask you whether this has led to lessons learned or any lessons for NATO members in terms of expeditionary versus neighbourhood activities.
I will answer that in a moment. I just have to add one small thing to my last answer, and that it's not true. It's a false statement that it was an agreement when Germany was unified that NATO should not have new members. So that's not true. But second, even if it was such an agreement, it would have been absolutely unacceptable that, in a way, the present that United States or someone else should agree on what Poland or Hungary or Latvia had the right to do. So it's double wrong. It's wrong because it didn't happen, and if it happened, it would have been wrong anyway. So that's not the case. Second, on Afghanistan. Of course, there are lessons learned from Afghanistan. And I think that the most important lesson, there are actually two lessons. One is that it was right to go into Afghanistan because it was necessary to react to an attack that killed thousands of people in Washington and in New York, the Twin Towers and the attack, also the 9/11 attacks. It was impossible to accept that Afghanistan remained a safe haven for international terrorists. It was a clear UN mandate. The international community supported it. and the NATO has been in a way the instrument for the international community to fight terrorism and to prevent Afghanistan becoming a safe haven for international terrorists. The other lesson I think we have learned from Afghanistan is that we should have started earlier to train local forces, because in the long run it is difficult to be in a way foreigners coming from NATO countries and partner countries and to fight the war in Afghanistan for the Afghans. So it's much better if local forces, forces from the country itself, can take responsibility for security and stability in its own country. And therefore, we have now ended our combat mission in Afghanistan. Since 2015, we are only in a, we call it a train, assist and advise mission, where we train and advise local Afghan forces. And I'm absolutely certain that in the long run, that's much more sustainable and viable solution, that we don't do the big combat operations, but we enable the Afghans themselves to stabilize their own country. This is a lesson which is relevant for Afghanistan. And if anything, we should have started to train local forces earlier, so we could have ended our own combat operations earlier. But I think it's also an important lesson learned for other countries. Because I think one of the best weapons we have against terrorism is to train local forces, is to enable local forces to fight terrorism themselves. Because the fight against terrorism is not a fight between the West and the Muslim world. Most of the victims of terrorist attacks are Muslims. So we have to enable countries in the region, in the Middle East, in North Africa, to fight ISIL, Daesh, terrorist organizations, themselves. In the long run, that's a more stronger weapon than we fighting their wars.
We have time for one more question. Let's go to the person over there. Yeah.
General Secretary, thank you for your time. I was wondering, what is NATO taking in steps into de-escalating the tension between the NATO alliance and Russia on a non-military basis? Thank you.
What we do is that we keep the channels for political dialogue open in different ways. We have something called the NATO-Russia Council, which is a council that was established back in the 1990s, where Russia and the 28 NATO allies meet. This kind of dialogue is important because it is important in a way to just sit around the same table and address some of our different security challenges. And even if we don't agree on all of them, I think it's important that we talk, that we have dialogue, that we speak, because that at least helps us to find solutions. For instance, we have discussed Ukraine. We didn't agree, but I think it's important that we meet, discuss Ukraine. We have discussed Afghanistan, and we have discussed what we call risk reduction and transparency. And that is about how can we avoid incidents, accidents related to military activity, because with more military buildup, more military activity along our borders, the risk for incidents, for accidents, has increased. And we saw the downing of the Russian plane over Turkey last year, and we have to try to do whatever we can to avoid that kind of also incidents or accidents. And if they do happen, prevent them from spiraling out of control and create really dangerous situations. So the higher tensions, the more military activity, the more important it is that we have direct dialogue, direct contact to avoid misunderstandings and miscalculations that can create really dangerous situations. So we do this, we continue to do that, and of course we also then continue to meet on political level. I met Foreign Minister Lavrov. My Deputy Secretary General has contact with her counterparts with Russian officials. So we continue to have, and also many NATO allies have on the bilateral level contacts, dialogue with Russia. I mentioned Norway, but also other NATO allies engage with Russia in different ways. For instance, the United States. The other thing is that NATO's response, our increased military presence, for instance, in the Baltic countries, is measured, is responsible. We speak about battalions, which is an important but limited military presence. So there's no way that can be a threat. NATO does not pose any threat to any country. So we also calibrate our military response in a way that contributes to keeping tensions down. We are there not to provoke, we are there to prevent conflict and to provide the necessary deterrence to make sure that all allies are safe in a more unstable world.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, firstly, join me in thanking Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.